Saturday morning show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. I am feeling rejuvenated and refreshed as a Toronto sports team has won. And I am reminded that things could be okay. I'll admit, how was your yesterday? How was your decompression chamber from the Toronto Maple Leafs loss? I know we had that extra day, but it felt like yesterday was okay. We're back in the swing of things. We're not prepping as much for this one Leafs moment. Now we have media day. Mm-hmm. So it's truth serum day, as I like to call it. So I'm going to ask you guys what you would ask the Toronto Maple Leafs if you get one truth serum dart. You get one dart. You shoot it into the neck of anyone in the Toronto Maple Leafs organization, and they got to tell you the truth about one question. We'll get to that in a second. But yeah, how was yesterday? Is it a little bit normality?
I think it was kind of therapeutic for me because we got it all out. We got to hear from the listeners. It's just like you unloaded your brain a bit. And then there was no other games on last night in terms of having to watch other teams in the NHL. So you kind of got like a little moment where like, hey, you know, this is fine. There's no other playoffs happening. And then tonight I'll be watching the Tampa Bay Lightning or whoever hell's playing. And you'll be like, oh, this sucks. So it was a kind of a nice get it out of your system and then regroup today and have 1,000 things that you want to talk about with Maple Leafs and to dig in deeper. So I thought it was helpful. Good therapy session.
It was fine. It's, I don't know.
It was fine, he said.
Well, I want to be like, oh, I'm over it, but I'm not
over it.
It's still...
I like Ailish's point that's why I feel this way. You're right, Ailish, is because yesterday I just watched the Jays, and it felt like a chill summer night where I went,
there's no playoffs
hey,
on anyway.
The Leafs lost, and so that's the end of hockey. That's really great. Do you know that the Panthers and the Lightning play a back-to-back in this round?
What?
Correct. That is the right reaction to have. Okay, so
I know they're neighbors, but that's not fair.
But okay, this is the conversation we could have been having about the Leafs and the Panthers had this been an actual series. But so they obviously play tonight. And by the way, I just want our listeners to know. So this is the way I normally handle things, and I'm curious to know in the text line today, because it's text line Tuesday. I want to know your truth serum questions for the Toronto Maple Leafs. So fire those away. I want to know if you want to run it back. What your biggest difficulty is when it comes to running it back, if you're even a believer in that, or what your biggest belief is counter to that, if your team change it up, shuffle it up. Nobody wants to blow it up. That's a straw man argument. But we won't be doing a lot of hockey talk for at least a round. It's kind of like, hey, it's a sensitive period around the hockey. So yeah, well, we'll probably talk Battle of Alberta. I'm guessing Battle of Alberta.
I was gonna say all the Eastern Conference teams are either the Tampa Bay Lightning or bad. Like you're just gonna sit there being like, Leafs are better than this team. Leafs are better than this team. This is frustrating.
Plus, I have a theory about the Lightning that I might share today on the Wake and Rake. But here's the schedule today: 7 o'clock. Then they play Thursday. You go, that makes sense. That's the day between. Then they play Sunday, and you go, wow, that's okay, that's extra days. And then they play Monday. And then they play Wednesday. And then they, like, it's all over the map.
You know, I'm okay with Leafs not being in this round.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
You know what? I don't want to have the back-to-back games.
It's not even legit. Back-to-back games is not legit. I had one guy, it was so funny. I you know me, and now I kind of mute Twitter. And the only times I forget to mute Twitter is once a tweet really blows up. Because I'm like, I should mute this one. I had one guy that was like, you can't call Tampa Mickey Mouse anymore. They've won 2 cups. I was like, you really missed all those jokes, right? Like, all the jokes about Tampa fans. You really you sat there all mad, and you were like, he can call them Mickey Mouse now, but if they beat the Leafs after 2 cups, then they're official. Then it's a real deal thing. A real deal thing is that Yusei Kikuchi. This is 3 starts in a row now where he's combined for 3 runs against. He's got a 1.56 ERA in May, and I don't want to say he's fixed or he's changed, but I'll tell you this. He's throwing 97 from the left, and he's dropping a pretty nasty slider in there, and he's talking post-game about how he and Pete Walker tried to shape his fastball exactly the way that Robbie Ray, who is not in Toronto for reasons unknown.
Unknown.
No, they're not. I think it's just the most known thing. I'm like, why do we even still do this? Like, why, we knew this was the case. We've known this is the case for months, and people keep kind of like dancing around it. I don't really understand it, but whatever. I think it's hilarious. Pete Walker, Yusei Kikuchi, is this going to be one of the stories of the season? Like, it's are you, how much are you buying this run of success? Because this is three starts in a row where you go, this is three nasty starts in a row. And this also includes the Yankees, right? Like, that wasn't just that Mariners lineup that has been hitting, by the way. But, like, he is shutting it down right now, Blake Murphy.
So, there is always with these things, you want to look for the why, right? It's like, okay, is he just getting better batted ball luck? Is he just missing a few more bats? Or has he fundamentally changed something? And the big, big thing for Kikuchi, and it's an obvious thing as a short-term fix, but your question becomes, how sustainable is it long-term? Is over these last couple starts, part of why he's had so much success is he's moved to being a two-pitch pitcher. Yep. He has historically thrown four pitches. Last year, he threw a pretty good mix. Like, he threw four different pitches at least 18% of the time last year. The fastball, the cutter, the slider, and the changeup. This year, he's entirely ditched the cutter over the last couple starts, and he really only works the changeup in to or sinker in to right-handed batters when he's in an advantageous situation. So last night, you look at it, and 83 of his 90 pitches are that 97-mile-an-hour fastball or that 90-mile-an-hour slider that has just vicious movement on it, and that him and Pete Walker have spent a ton of time tweaking the delivery on, so it's harder to pick up against the fastball. So, yeah, if you were... This is the thing that relievers always do, right? It's like, oh, a starter might have more success in the bullpen because they can ditch a pitch and get rid of your worst pitch. And Robbie Ray last year was like, focus on the fastball-slider combo. Focus on the fastball-slider combo. You've got a tertiary pitch in the right situation, but you're mostly a two-pitch guy. Kevin Gausman turned his career around in part by just being like, you know what? Two-pitch guy now. Fastball-splitter. And again, you keep that tertiary offering as a... you know, in a good count or when the other stuff's not working. But these last couple starts, Kikuchi's basically been like, no, my other pitches weren't working. The fastball and the slider are really tough to hit against still. And until you show you can hit those, I'm not going to throw you the cutter and the changeup. And it's been really effective. So the question from here becomes, you know, is that sustainable over a whole season? Robbie Ray and Kevin Gausman would tell you yes. So yeah, it's nice that not only is he pitching better, but there's a very easy explanation for why.
Yeah, 75% of his pitches right now are those two, right? The four-seamer and the slider. Those are now accounting for the vast majority of his arsenal. Also of note, with his ability to kind of shift to this, that's clearly been an uptick in his velocity year over year. Like, his average fastball velocity is now up. I just think that it's a couple things. One is the location right now is also pretty nasty. He's really hitting his spots, and you can just see that again. Like, when you're watching him pitch yesterday, when he is throwing that heat in on guys' hands, it looks tough. It looks really, really tough because he'll locate that slider inside on you as well. And it is just, it really had those Mariners guys twisted up yesterday. You saw that, to a pretty similar degree with the Yankees. I would just say, like, six hits in these last three starts, right? That's all that he's conceded. There's been a little bit of, you get a little worried once he hits the fifth inning. Because that's typical of, hey, if we're talking about a reliever profile, it's the deeper that you go into games, the more concerned that you become when the pitch mix is a little bit more 1-2. But yeah, so far right now, Yusei Kikuchi is like completely shot up the confidence rankings. The aesthetics of it are so much nicer when he's not getting squared up for hard hit contact. I would say that the only thing is still is that yesterday he dealt to the tune of, I think it was two hits through 5 2/3, or that one, once it was six innings, and we were like 2+ hours into the baseball game, despite there being no base runners for either team. And I went, okay. I was like, even in this way that we're still doing it. Okay. That's the positive to me from yesterday's game, is that it really does seem like the Jays might have four starting pitchers. And we can debate where Jose Berríos is at. But again, he's such a consistent guy over the last bunch of years that he's just someone I can't really go with the May numbers even if there are a lot of pretty tough signs right now. I'm going to take the Kikuchi ones, and I'm going to say that if this ends up working out, we actually, like, Pete Walker becomes what in terms of coaches in this city of this guy got the most out of people?
Yeah, it's huge. I don't know. It's one of those weird things where, like, obviously the pitchers themselves get credit, and obviously we don't talk a lot about the ones of these that didn't work out, right? Like the Jaime Garcia or the Tanner Roark, like those gambles didn't pay off. But those are different though.
Like Jaime Garcia didn't come here as a Blue Jays were going to tweak this guy. He came here as they were like, this is a good lottery ticket. And Tanner Roark came here as a, oh my God, no one's signing here and we have big bags of money and we're supposed to be taking a step. Okay, Tanner Roark, will you come here? We need an innings eater. He wasn't like a project for Pete Walker, right? And I'm sure there are names that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head, but this is numerous guys now that Pete Walker has taken with his philosophy as of late and totally changed them. And the Mets aren't regretting their decision because look at where they are in the standings right now, and everything in the Mets land is happy, happy, joy, joy. But Pete Walker was up for manager jobs this past offseason, and what did we say? You can't lose Pete Walker. And frankly, it is a weird situation right now where obviously Charlie Montoyo is the manager, but if you had to say you have to sacrifice Charlie Montoyo or Pete Walker, it wouldn't even be a debate. For any Blue Jays fan, there's tangible, hard evidence that Pete Walker might be the most valuable pitching coach in baseball. Like, I know we're not tracking this across all of the sport, but I'm curious. Like, we have Jake Arrieta on today. He's got a new podcast. He's a guy who won a Cy Young. I can't wait to ask him, you know, what he makes of the amount of credit a guy like Pete Walker gets when it's year over year. Because there's no way that other pitchers aren't paying attention to what this guy is doing with guys who have hit blips in their career. Robbie Ray walked every human being on earth, and then he came to Toronto and he started walking nobody, he won a Cy Young. Like, he always had stuff. Kikuchi had stuff, and he made an all-star team last year, but go look at his numbers. If he turns into something close to what he's been the last couple of games, because he's not going to be 1.56 ERA, all right? But, like, let's just say he's a 3 ERA guy. That's a huge drop-off from where he was a season ago. And it's just, you believe in the power of Pete. I believe in the power of Pete, all right? The power of Pete. Make me a t-shirt. Yeah.
I don't know where my sentence was going when you jumped in there, but it wasn't to not give Pete Walker credit. It was just to say these things are imperfect, but the upside of the hits is so much greater than the downside of any of the misses that all you need is a couple hits scattered around. And yeah, it's a Pete Walker shared credit thing with the whatever they call their analytics team that works on pitch design and stuff like that. They're a really smart organization when it comes to this kind of stuff and limiting. It's an interesting approach where it's like, okay, guys come in with like, oh, here's the red ink on the profile. And the Jays are just like, well, why don't we just ignore that and just focus on the really good stuff and make the really good stuff even better. And yeah, it's something you don't want to do with like a 22, 23 year old, maybe, because there's still room for them to figure it all out. But when you're talking about a Robbie Ray or Yusei Kikuchi and they're 30 years old, and it's like, okay, you're at the point in your career where like you are who you are, let's maximize this version of that. They've had a ton of success with it. It's awesome. I honestly wonder the Pete Walker manager stuff. It's like, I don't know. You want him in a pitching coach role, I think. I'll pay him like a manager. Yes. But if it really is him who is the head of this pitching development snake, then you wouldn't want to bump him from the role. That would be a promotion in name only, not in scope and impact.
No, 100%. Like, I'm not advocating for him to get that job. I'm saying that I hope they don't lose him. I hope that he just continues to be the pitching coach for the Toronto Blue Jays, because he appears to be the best at it right now. He goes into now what will be, I'm going to say, the Alex McKechnie Hall of Fame of guys who are on your bench or a part of your staff that are like now being universally praised at the best at their job by the rest of the fans. Like, if you recall Alex McKechnie, everyone being like, Kawhi can't leave Toronto because McKechnie is here. Well, I wonder if there are going to be certain pitchers, at least some guys with nasty stuff who, it's money, 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 right? But I wonder if a tipping point for the Blue Jays could end up actually being that they have somebody who has a pretty proven track record. If you've got stuff, he might be able to help you out. Okay, so that's the positive from yesterday's pitching. Kikuchi's great. He's looking good. Takes a long time, but if the results are there, you'll watch.
Hey, I'd rather watch a long win than a short loss.
Correct. Correct. The negative. Jordan Romano was not available in that game, and it was after we got word that Tim Mesa, who is probably the Blue Jays' most underappreciated player, I would say, was slapped to the 15-day DL. The Blue Jays' bullpen last night has a moment where Trevor Richards goes in, and it's a, hey, Trevor, go out there and do your job. Last year, you were a seventh-inning guy. This year, please be a seventh-inning guy. And he goes out there and he says, I'm not really a seventh-inning guy, is basically the message that he was trying to deliver to the Blue Jays last night. His numbers have regressed. And if you look at Trevor Richards' career numbers, last season was a bit of an anomaly. And that's the case with relief pitchers, right? Like, it's a, hey, sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. I think everybody feels a little bit more confidence in Phelps this season, but I don't think that Phelps should be your number two reliever, which right now he might be, depending on your feelings on Adam Simber, who also had to make appearance in that game because they went to our guy Chicken Strip in the ninth inning when the game looked to be out of hand. But yeah, if you look at the Blue Jays bullpen right now, they brought in Jimmy Garcia, who has been fine, but Jimmy Garcia's numbers, do you know who they profile closest to on the Toronto Blue Jays this season? His numbers are almost identical. And the leverage is completely different, so please save it if you're going to freak out on me. His numbers are almost identical with Trent Thornton's. He strikes out less guys, and he walks fewer batters. But if you go across the board and you went pitcher A, pitcher B, you did one of those blind Twitter tests and said, which one of these guys would you rather have? You might have some people that get tricked into picking Trent Thornton. I'm just saying it hasn't exactly been wow, Jimmy Garcia is the perfect signing for this baseball team. He's been a good reliever, but if he's your best reliever and Adam Simber is your second best and Phelps is your third, all of a sudden the Blue Jays bullpen appears to be in a, I'm going to say it, it's in a spot very similar to last season where you feel very, very, very small degree of confidence for this group right now. It's tough.
Jimmy Garcia, career low swinging strike rate. Right now, zero whiffs in that game last night. And I know he pulled them out of that one. You know, like Trevor Richards came in and three base runners immediately, and they get one of them out, and then Jimmy kind of loads them back up and gets out of it. That's great. But it continues to be the story. And Garcia is the best example of it because he is a guy who's missed bats in the past, at least at a better level than this. But he's a good snapshot of the entire Blue Jays bullpen, which is there are a lot of guys who you can throw out there in the sixth and seventh, and hey, it's a three-run game, and if you pitch to contact and allow one, well, whatever, we'll work around that. That's why you get a bigger lead, but a whole bullpen built out of those guys gets tougher. It's not a good sign when Trevor Richards has the second-best strikeout rate in your bullpen, because like you just said, for most of his career, he's been just the guy. He got $1 million in arbitration, or to avoid arbitration this summer. He's like kind of one of those guys you see get churned at the end of the roster. Simber's not missing bats. Thornton's not missing bats. Garcia's not missing bats. Even Phelps, like, he could strike a guy out, but he's not a big, big bat misser so far this season, and he's having a lot of trouble with the walks. Your only guy who could really miss bats was Merriweather, and he had to send him down because when he didn't miss bats, it was jumping out of the yard every time. And regardless of the individual stuff, you got six innings of one-hit ball from Yusei Kikuchi last night, and you got six runs from your offense, and you still had to burn five bullpen arms. That's bad. Even though those five bullpen arms combined for two runs allowed and one of them was unearned, it's a wasted opportunity to continue rolling through the series and a week where you have, you know, you do have Thursday off, but still, you want to take the series. You want guys available. It's a waste to have to use five guys to get out of three innings against, you know, Seattle's been good, but you shouldn't need to use five guys to get three innings.
So this is a question that I have for you, and it's something that I want to explore throughout the week with some of our guests, especially people who are like around the Blue Jays a little bit more, maybe. How much of this is just like an organizational failure, frankly? Like, okay, I get it, but nobody wants to pay for bullpen arms, right? Like, that's the cardinal sin of the baseball nerddom right now. Is everybody is at a consensus. We have officially created a groupthink that you do not pay for relief pitchers, and that's bearing out in the markets. It's just like you don't really do it as much because, yeah, relievers are volatile and blah, 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 blah. But if you look at the Tampa Bay Rays or you look at the New York Yankees bullpen right now, it's like, what do they have? They have these live arms that come out of the bullpen and can snap just incredible velocity and strike people out. And it's a bit of a confusion to me that the Blue Jays got away with out that last year to start the year, right? It basically, I don't want to say it unraveled the year, but if you're saying, okay, why did the Blue Jays miss the playoffs last year, right? You would point to a couple things. Well, they had a lull later in the season when they had kind of a softer spot in the schedule and they didn't take advantage of it. But out of the gates, their bullpen killed them against some of their most important opponents. This year, they came into the season, Romano, okay, awesome. Also somebody that has dealt with some injury stuff in the past, but whatever. He's Jordan Romano. He's a great closer. We've seen that when he's at his best. They signed Garcia. Okay, he's one of the better relievers available on the market. They gave him some cash. They brought him in. But it wasn't a mystery that they didn't have a ton of live arms in this bullpen. And I wonder how much of that is like a lack of development thing. How much of that is not having guys in your farm system that you do bring up as relief pitchers that are supposed to be there and be those live arms? Why don't you have those guys? Like, why are the Blue Jays the only organization in their division that doesn't have those nasty arms that come out of the pen? Like, they just don't. They do not have arms.
Feels like we're just desperately waiting for Nate Pearson. Like,
but Nate Pearson's supposed to still be a starter too, though. Mm-hmm. And now I shouldn't be thinking, and I don't think that fans should be thinking, boy, you really need Nate Pearson to come up here mm-hmm. and bail out your bullpen. You should be thinking, boy, if Hyunjin Ryu really can't find it at some point this year, I don't want to see Ross Stripling start over Nate Pearson if you have an opportunity to do that. Like, I want to see Nate Pearson start. And now all of a sudden, Ailish, I'm with you where I'm going, is Nate going to end up being the eighth inning guy now? Like, it's a weird position for them to be in yet again.
Yeah, and a couple things have led to this. And one is, yeah, you haven't developed relief pitchers super well. Another is you've been
super well, like at all.
Yeah, and you've been maybe a little slow to convert failed starters to relievers. Like, think of, say, a Thomas Hatch. You need starting depth at AAA for sure. You don't want to convert a starter to a reliever until you're absolutely sure that guy's not going to make it as a starter. But if you drag your feet on converting those guys, then the guys who would ostensibly be your relief depth aren't as far along on their relief development. So you look at, I mean, Hatch and Anthony Kay have both been just getting shelled at AAA this year. So maybe it's time. I was a real believer in Hatch. I blame Eno Saris of The Athletic, where he does this like stuff metric that measures how good a guy's stuff is regardless of like command and stuff like that. And Thomas Hatch is always like among the leaders in the minors.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm still believing. Eno says that his stuff is really good. His little black box algorithm says it's good. There are two names to watch coming up. Three, really. Andrew Vasquez got recalled for Tim Mesa. Pitched 8 shutout appearances down there with 12 strikeouts over 9 innings. So that's a lefty fastball slider combo. They won't put him in high leverage spots, but maybe you see something. The two names to watch, though, would be Graham Spraker and Adrian Hernandez. Spraker had like a bit of a breakout in Arizona Fall League last year and has been pretty good. He's thrown 16 innings out of the pen for them with a 2.70 ERA and 21 strikeouts. Some control issues, though. And then Adrian Hernandez is the other one. He's appeared out of the bullpen 8 times, 2 saves, 13 Ks to just 3 walks. And he's a guy that I think Arden was on with us and mentioned him as like one of his under the radar guys to watch. And he's only 22, but he's already in the bullpen development because he's only 5'8". And they were like pretty confident right away, this guy's only going to be a bullpen arm. So that's a good example of like, hey, if you make those decisions earlier, you might have guys coming up in the pipeline for the bullpen. So the other element of this is that this front office just very much believes you can cobble together a bullpen on the fly in season.
I don't know if that – this is – you know what? We're about to get to the Toronto Maple Leafs, and we're about to talk about like whether or not philosophy should change. Well, maybe the bullpen philosophy of like cobbling it together if it screws you 2 years in a row where you're trying to win a World Series, or it's not going to keep you out of the playoffs this year because, boy – given the playoff format and given the teams that are out of the gate so far, it really does look like the Jays are going to be pressed to miss, in my opinion. Like, it's going to be – if they miss, it's going to be a pretty cataclysmic failure. But either way, we'll see where the bullpen's at in a couple months, but I don't like the look of it right now. And you're right. I think that's a huge part of it, Blake, is that they've had guys in the organization that were supposed to be like the legend. Remember the legend of Patrick Murphy? Oh, Patrick Murphy, this guy is supposed to be blah, 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 blah. Well, guess what? Didn't really work
out. By the way, did you see the way that guy on Seattle spells his last name Murphy last night?
Yes.
M-U-R-F-E-E? What are we doing here, Penn? Penn Murphy. It's like someone, I get pulled over and somebody, the cop asks me my name and I'm trying, scrambling to think of it. And then I see a pen on my dash and I'm like, oh, Murphy, but it's spelled F-E. What the heck is that?
So
I don't like that.
Yep. But you're right. The Thomas Hatches. Thomas Hatch was looking great for the Blue Jays out of the bullpen, right? In that 2020 season, they tried to stretch him out and it hasn't been the same since. And I get it. There is a temptation right now to have these guys be starters because, and it's usually the correct one, but every once in a while you have to be like, no, it's not. And the guy I think of with that is Roberto Osuna, where everyone said, yo, you got to stretch this guy out and take a look at a starter. Sometimes you got to go, no, you don't. They're just a really good reliever. And I kind of think that maybe they made that mistake with Thomas Hatch. Didn't think we'd be having a Thomas Hatch conversation right now, but it speaks to the greater miss of the philosophy,
exactly,
which is that
they haven't taken those guys.
Right, of that have stuff that worked in the bullpen that haven't been able to work as starters. Now you've got a bunch of starting pitchers who can basically all confidently give you six outside of Ryu. You got four guys that all of a sudden you're feeling like, oh, they can give you six innings. How do you get to the rest of the game? I don't really see anybody there now that the Romano and Mesa injuries have happened.
Yeah, and I'm a believer in don't convert a starting pitching prospect to the bullpen until you have to, whether that's because they've flamed out or whether that's because your major league team needs it, but this team is in a win-now window, and if you're Thomas Hatch and you're turning 28 this year and you're still struggling at AAA as a starter, it's time. Like, I know that you need starting pitching depth, but if the next guy up at AAA, you'd be terrified to start him, I don't consider that starting pitching depth.
Yeah. I will say, too, and I want to move on now to the Leafs. And again, it's Text Line Tuesday, 590-590. You can ask Blue Jays questions, whatever you want. I just assume today is going to be a lot of Leafs. But whenever you say Buffalo guys who have good numbers, I think who's the Blue Jays had a Bison's closer from a couple of years ago closer in Buffalo, made the minor league all-star team and then came up to the majors and it's like couldn't get an out, right? And it's like, so I'm always pretty dubious of the AAA numbers, especially. I usually even think the AA numbers are the ones where I go, oh, it's a little more interesting. But either way, it's truth serum time. Today, the Toronto Maple Leafs are speaking to the media. We will hear from everyone maybe a little bit during our show, starting at around 9:30. It's always a day that's pretty... it's usually pretty interesting because it's more contentious the last couple of years. This year, I don't think that it'll have that same vibe, which maybe creates a little bit more honesty. Although people say that you're most honest when you're angry. So maybe this will allow the Toronto Maple Leafs to kind of hide their true intentions better. It's always, this is platitude season, baby. We're going to get the new messaging. It was last year, it was Killer Instinct. This year, it's going to be whatever it is.
What's the new jingle this year?
What's the new unveiling that we will all use going into next year's playoff failure? Woohoo, Toronto Maple Leafs says we are here. So this time, usually, and it's their job, but this is conceal season, right? Veil season. Kyle Dubas is, I think, a pretty honest guy. Brendan Shanahan has been a pretty honest guy. I don't think hockey players generally are, but you've gotten some honest moments from the Toronto Maple Leafs players as well. Ailish Forfar, It's truth serum time. I hand you a dart, and I say, this dart contains truth serum, and if you inject it into any member of the Toronto Maple Leafs, they will tell you the truth about one question. Who will you use it on and what will you ask?
I would ask for three more darts. I'm just kidding. Yeah. if I have to pick my number one point of inquiry would be I would shoot my dart into Austin Matthews' forearm and I would ask him.
It only works in the neck.
Okay, I was going to say the neck, but I didn't know if aggressive.
Yeah, he hates you.
Okay,
he's upset.
In the neck.
You're giving him another tattoo.
In the neck. Yeah. Is Sheldon Keefe the right coach for you to win the Stanley Cup? That is my question. I want to get in the mind of that locker room into someone that is vitally important to the Maple Leafs' future, who I want to be happy, who I want to stay here, who I want to feel like has some leadership, even though he doesn't have the C. I think that he's someone that should have the C. So I want to know from Austin Matthews, is Sheldon Keefe the coach that's going to get you there?
So he's the guy that matters the most. And exactly. So
I want him to be happy. Oof. More than
I have, naturally, I have cheated at this game, and I have written a couple down just in case, mm-hmm. depending on what your guys' answers were, I was going to go in different directions. But my one of, like, I have a dart for a couple of people because mm-hmm. I'm not going to waste my dart on someone that you guys already used your dart on, right? Like,
that's
but,
right.
But my Matthews question would have been something very similar, which is, what are the things that matter most to you this coming year? Like, how do you think that this team is going to win? Is it just the run it back? Is it just, like, he, I think you're in a really unique position with Austin Matthews where it's like, do you give him that little bit of power? Because players generally make the worst general managers, right? Like, we just saw LeBron piss away the end of his legacy by putting himself out there for Russell Westbrook and his side of the backboard clanging jump shots that he took with reckless abandon all season long. I'm not sure that Austin Matthews even wants that responsibility, but I am kind of curious what the approach would be if you asked him, hey, like, what level of input do you want? Do you want to try to help find a different coach? Do you want to endorse a coach? Do you want to still pick your line mates? Let's not forget that Mike Babcock had to go down to Arizona early in Austin Matthews' career and try to hash things out with him and find out what he wanted. I think that we assume that because hockey players are to the public anyways, generic and often, I don't want to say soft-spoken, but non-controversial, let's just say, mm-hmm. and that even the slightest controversial comment can be interpreted in a certain way, that doesn't mean that they're these incredibly competitive creatures who have thoughts and opinions on these teams. You're seeing this around sports right now, right? Quarterbacks who are entering their contract seasons are saying, here's how I feel about the team. Here's how I feel about the roster. It's not just Aaron Rodgers anymore that's doing this, right? Like, it used to be just the big-time quarterbacks that would have massive says within the organization. Now there are different guys that want a little bit of play. This is the player empowerment era, and I wonder how much of that is reaching hockey, and I do wonder what Austin Matthews' priorities are. Does he care about the captaincy? Does he want that? Does he like Sheldon Keefe as a head coach? Does he care if he's split up from Mitch Marner? Or, like, how big of a deal is it if he is split up from him? Like, these are all going to be unbelievably important questions moving forward here, because I think we all agree, Leafs lose Matthews. Even if he says he wants out and they trade Matthews in that final year before his deal expires, it is, like, I've joked about this before.
Loss.
Maybe you guys have heard of my jokes about Austin Matthews before, but neither of you even smiled. Yeah, it would be a calamity if they lose him. It would be a disaster. It would be a, wow, I don't know how the Leafs recover from losing Matthews.
I don't know how they would. So that's a good use of the truth serum bullet. I like that, Ailish, you and I get one truth serum thing, and JD's coming in like strapped like Rambo.
No, I'm just prepared for... Listen, I'm just ready to pivot.
Oh,
okay?
I got a couple more in my back pocket.
I'm ready to pivot.
Got,
so then we can use more darts. We can use more darts, all right? We can use more darts. Blake Murphy, what's your truth serum bullet?
Yeah, I mean, this was a smaller one, but just to play off the Keefe thing, I'd hit Jason Spezza and ask him, what?
I'm looking at Jason Spezza with the dart in his neck going, Blake, you've wasted our dart. Like, you, but okay, sorry, go on.
Well, by all accounts, he's one of the smartest guys on the team. He cared a ton during this stretch. He obviously felt there was...
He's the only leader, too.
He obviously seemed like there was a hole in the leadership of the communication to step up the way he did at the intermission of that game. And I'd be very curious, given his level of experience, given how highly everyone speaks of him as an intelligent hockey mind, given that we know he wants to eventually make the move to the team side with stuff, what his assessment of Keefe's performance has been. And I mean, a sub one of that is like, do you think you could do a better job at the head coach job, Spezza? Because we could bump you to the bench if you really want. But he's the guy whose take I'd really want on it more than anyone else. Like yes, you want Austin Matthews' take because he's the face of the franchise. He's also only played for two coaches in his career, and he's only known this situation. It's the same with a couple other guys on the roster. You've only known this situation, and Spezza's the guy. I don't know. It stands out to me a lot that the biggest sub storyline of the playoffs was Spezza standing up at an intermission and taking the communication reins. And I'd want to pick his brain on whether that was him doing that as a player leader or him doing that because he felt it wasn't coming from somewhere else.
Okay, that's interesting, though, because when you say it's not coming from somewhere else, I actually completely – this is where I actually say good job by Sheldon Keefe stepping aside because this is not one where when you say leadership, I think this is a great use of this truth serum dart. I think that I'm shocked because when I first saw you shoot it into Spezza's neck, I was terrified because I was like, what is this guy – he's what does he know about anything? This is a perfect use of him, though, is – what do you see as the flaws when it comes to leadership of this group? Because we've all been talking about, like, killer instinct, right? And if he's had to be the one that's talking John Tavares down after John Tavares has a bad moment on the bench, he's the one that has to settle down the group when Mitch Marner notices a loose chin strap and is yelling at officials. By the way, Marner didn't get enough credit for actually even noticing that. Like, that was sharp. Like, that's a sharp mind to notice that right away. That's like Chris Paul stuff, although maybe I don't get to use Chris Paul stuff anymore after another exit in the playoff resume.
Good for you. You're the biggest crybaby.
Yeah. No, please don't say that. But what does he think about about Tavares' leadership? What does he feel about, like, the growth of the younger guys as leaders? What does he think about their ability in those moments? Because Jason Spezza isn't going to be there forever. And what happens if he wasn't in that game in the series?
Yeah. Like, and it's a bad thing that we've done that every year of, hey, you need to bring in experienced leaders. You have to bring in Thornton and Marlowe and Spezza and Giordano and stuff like that. Like, those guys can contribute, sure. But the fact that, you know, at a certain point, you want your core guys to be the leadership group.
This is an excellent truth serum dart. This is a really,
I like that you thought I was going to ask him, like, hey, so you think Colin Blackwell could handle playing third line minutes?
No. I thought that it was going to be like, do you want to work in a front office someday? I was like, who cares? This is a desperate offseason. We need to figure this out. No, it's a great question. You're right. His perspective on this would be very, very interesting. Why do you have to be the one that continues to fill the leadership void? What would have happened if Kyle Clifford doesn't hit someone from behind in this series or Wayne Simmonds doesn't take two bad penalties? I keep mentioning this, but the Leafs were down in four straight games to Tampa. Mm-hmm. And yes, they deserve credit for coming back in those hockey games, but Jack Campbell really did battle to keep them in some games. And Jason Spezza rallied this group. We were very close to, you didn't go 7 with Tampa Bay. And how different is the conversation today if that is the case? And when we're talking about run it back, so much of the counter to it is, well, what about the stuff between the ears? And it's pretty crucial to know where exactly that's at. And if you gave Spezza the truth serum dart and he tells you that he doesn't think that the core is ready to lead or that there is some inherent flaw, you could end up having the answer that gives you the one to my truth serum, which is, I would use my truth serum dart. That's me doing. I just did a fake.
It was pretty good.
You got a dart in your neck, man.
You got a dart in your neck. We should have prepared that drop. That would have been probably as good as a call. I would use it on Kyle Dubas. And I would just simply say right away, once the serum started to seep through his body, I would say, Kyle, how aggressive are you going to be this offseason? Because Blake brought it up with Elliot yesterday about how other GMs are going to come to you and they're going to lowball you. Mm-hmm. But that's what GMs are supposed to do. Like, I don't want to imagine a GM that shows up and is like, here's my over-the-top offer. Here's way too much. Yeah, here's my best offer right away. That's not going to be the GM that's in business for very long. But we know that people are going to come to you and pick up the phone and say, is William Nylander available? They'll get crazy even, maybe even ask you if other players are available. But how aggressive will you be in terms of looking at potential changes to your roster? Because I don't know if the Leafs should make changes, but here's what I do know. At this point down the line, after this many playoff failures, you have to at least be open to changing things from your philosophy. And Dubas has tweaked it in the past, and I've given him credit for that, right? Like, it hasn't always been the same formula moving forward. But at this point, having the four forwards all tied up with that much money, you have to at least question it. And so if I'm Dubas, this can't be the offseason where I just sit back and let the offers come to me. This might have to be an offseason where I go out and ask other people what they would give back for a certain amount of my players. So if you're Kyle Dubas, how aggressive will you be? That would be my question.
Yeah, and I think that's on everybody's mind. We've bounced around for the last 2 days, and right after the game, there's, okay, you know, shut it down or let's sell some core four or let's run it back. And I think everybody's in that boat of anything is on the table, right? So knowing today, what would be on the table would be great. And then we could start speculating. Then we could say, okay, this person would be a great fit. But not knowing the direction of are you tinkering or are you making massive moves is the thing that gives me the most inquiry for the next off season all summer long. It's like, I want to know the belief that they might have in this or the belief in we need to do something. I need to have an off season for my job, for my future as well. So that's a great one. I think there'll be a lot of inquiry around Dubas and what he thinks this team looks like in the fall. So yeah, maybe I'll throw another truth serum in there just to really get the honest answer.
I think he's
he double dosing him.
Yeah, the guy can think. I don't know what a double dose does. Like, we got to avoid that.
It's like when they give Stanley the two horse tranquilizers in the office, and he can't. He has to put him down the stairs.
I know Kyle Dubas can tinker. He's tinkered every off season. He's a tinkerer. Tinker Taylor. What is it? Soldier Spy. He's Tinker. Yeah, sure. Okay. He's Tinker. I want to know if he can make a major splash or what it would be like if he was at least willing to do it. I think he would be willing to do it if he was brought the right offer. I wonder if he would bring the right offer to another team and start the dialogue. If he thinks that there is a better way to improve the club, what that would actually look like if it did involve shaking the core philosophy of this team. And again, you might say that that's lunacy, that they were so close, but this many times in, I think you have to at least discuss it. You have to at least pursue it. You have to at least consider it. You don't have to necessarily accept it. Again, we'll get your thoughts all day today. It's Text Line Tuesday, 590-590. You can always reach us on Twitter or on Instagram, at JD Bunkus, at Ailish Forfar, and at E. Blake Murphy. We're going to take a break, because what's on the A-list?
Is a legend returning to the ring? That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Text Line Tuesday. Keep putting them in there. 590-590. I've been scrolling through lots of Leafs questions with the truth serum. So I can't wait to get to those after the break. But a little baby A-list for you. And I teased it with a little Ric Flair. Josh, let's play the clip.
Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
Foremost wrestling show, Blake Murphy, wrestling brain. I got to put this one in here. Legend Ric Flair headed back to the ring for one last time on July 31st. Just announced that 73-year-old has not wrestled since 2011 in his final match for Sting. Obviously going to be in a massive event, 16-time world championship, a world champion. The match will supposedly take place the day after WWE SummerSlam this summer, but his opponent yet to be announced. I have to ask you both who you think it's going to be. He had that tussle with Kenny Omega last August in some AAA Mexico City promotion. I did my research, but not sure if that's going to be the guy that he wants to end his career finally in the ring with. I'm sure, Blake, you're just biting at the bit here to...
I actually have thoughts on this too, surprisingly.
Oh, let's go, wrestling show. Who's it going to be?
Yeah, well, in terms of his opponent, they're going to work a multi-man match so that Ric Flair doesn't have to do the whole match himself. He could just kind of stand on the outside, come in, do his big spots, do his chop, do his woo, do his strut. But you're not going to have him work like a proper thing. The rumor right now is it'll be Ric Flair and FTR, who are a tag team from all over the place, but
what's
primarily
FTR's full name?
It's one of those things that it doesn't stand for anything anymore.
Oh, I've never heard of FTR.
Called the Revival in WWE.
Okay, I don't.
They're one of the best tag teams in the world, and they're very like into the history of wrestling and stuff. So it's supposed to be them and Ric Flair against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, one of Ric Flair's most legendary opponents when he was active, and the Rock and Roll Express, who are one of the most legendary tag teams. But basically, this is going to be, you got a bunch of 60 and 70 year olds in the ring, and then this young tag team that's going to have to do all the actual work and keep everyone safe and stuff like that, just so Ric Flair can get his spots in.
All right. This is a lot of loose skin in the ring.
It's,
it's a lot of loose skin loosened around.
Little lipo ad.
It's just not great. A lot of tanning booths, I'm guessing, in this situation here, too.
I think they're more of a spray group
spray group, yeah.
But you sweat that off. That's nerve-wracking. You're going to have, like, little orange puddles on the ground.
Wouldn't it be the first time I've seen a little orange spot on the ring apron.
On the ring. Okay, so I think this is really sad, because if you've seen the Ric Flair documentary, this guy is unable to enter reality outside of his character. And this just kind of seems to be a continuation of this. Like, he's in his 70s and he's going to go do a match. And this isn't one of those we're laughing with you scenarios. Ric Flair's been around, right? Like, this isn't, oh my God, Ric Flair's going to go. This isn't Stone Cold Steve Austin coming back to WrestleMania, where he's been successful in other ventures and he's just, you know, sure, he's still Stone Cold to people as his main marketing thing, but I don't think that he goes around the world and goes, Stone Cold says so still to people. Like, you know what I mean? As his only
persona.
He's also
20 years younger.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Ric Flair being in his late 70s and the fact that he's never been able to retire. And I don't mean retire in the sense of, well, just end your career because, yeah, it's fine to work in your 70s. That's great. I mean in terms of, like, that he's never just been himself, that he's continued to just be Ric Flair despite the numerous losses he's had in his life. And, yeah, the clear pain that surrounds him. And the damage that is in his wake is, like, not to get dark in the A-list. Normally, this is A-list's spot. But I see Ric Flair as a 73-year-old guy in that ring. And I'm not going to feel any level of nostalgia. And if I don't know how many wrestling fans will either. Because he's been around. He's been omnipresent. Because this is all he's ever had. And it's all he's ever accepted himself to be. And that, to me, is just beyond dark and sad. Like, it's the movie The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, except for, like, somehow more sad and depressing is Ric Flair's life.
Well, it can't be a more depressing finish than that movie, I hope, because
let's not do that.
No spoilers.
Blake went even further than I did. Yes. Okay, good. I'm not the one to blame.
That's a movie, and like, it's based very loosely on Jake the Snake Roberts, who's dealt with some of the same issues that Ric Flair has in terms of alcoholism and loss in your life and stuff like that. Ric Flair's 73 years old. This is this is anything other than he's standing on the outside hyping the crowd up, and then he gets one tag in to do his clothesline chop strut.
Chop.
If it's anything more than that, if Ric Flair is blading at 73 years old, because no one has bladed more in their career than Ric Flair. Like, if that guy's heart rate goes past 80, his forehead starts bleeding. Like, it's that better be all this is.
All right, do we have a fun one?
We have a fun one. Okay,
Let's switch it up.
Okay, so somebody like myself with a unique name, I obviously have to share this one. Okay. We all know Wander Franco of the Tampa Bay Rays, but did you know that his father's name is also Wander Franco? And did you know that he also has a brother named Wander Franco? And did you also know that he has a second brother named Wander Franco? And did you also know that he has a son named Wander Franco?
Okay.
And they also have a brother, Michael.
Yeah.
Not sure what happened there. Why he didn't get the honor of being a Wander Franco.
Family loves Michael. Like, I...
Poor guy. What's worse, being one of the Wanders or the one guy named Michael?
Yeah, it's true. It's like, I just want to be one of the Wander Brothers.
This is like how... So Gary Trent is Gary Trent Jr. And one of his brother's name is Gary's son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like Gary's son, and then Grayson and Graydon. Like Gary Trent Sr. was just like, I'm gonna quadruple down on
five Wander Francos in their family, and they're also set to have another child this summer. So, is it another Wander Franco? Stay tuned. Maybe Wanda.
So
if the baby's a girl.
The most famous obviously in this regard is George Foreman, right? He is, I think,
the 10 Georges.
Yeah, he's got a Georgina, right? Like, or a Georgette, in terms of his daughters. He is the apple in the garden of famous people naming their kids after themselves. He's got the George Jr., George the Fourth, George the Fifth, George the Sixth, and their nicknames are Monk, Big Wheel, Red, and Little Joey, which is my favorite. When his name is George, is your Little Joey. I don't know. This, it's just the weirdest thing to me when this happens with people. Like, I just don't understand why you would ever want to have your kids be in that spot, especially when you're a famous person. Like, I don't know if Wander Franco's dad was famous, but I think that's weird. Like, I just...
It's got to be Wander, so chaotic in that household. I know they probably all have nicknames and stuff like that, or get called by their middle names.
But why? Why? I just don't understand it. And it's just one of those awkward things you got to tell. Imagine being, George the Sixth, whereas the sixth George Foreman kid who's like, and also George, George the Sixth, and we'll call you Little Joey. And he's like, God damn it. It's like, can I have my own identity outside of this, right? Like, and you've heard this too, like LeBron, guys who have named their sons after them, some of them, the celebrity types anyways.
Yeah. Ronald.
But they usually say, I regret it, right? Gary Payton has said he regrets it because he's done it a couple of times. And
look, I'm a third. LeBron did it. Yeah. I'm a third. Nobody calls me by that name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nobody could. My family was we're going to use this family name.
But it's not it's not when it's just one. Like, one is a normal move. It's when you start to go, if all of your brothers were Blake Murphy, yeah, that would be a little strange. Well,
yeah, not the Blake part of my
name. Yeah, I know. Yeah. But
I like the idea, too, of like, so Wander Franco, everyone calls him El Patron, like the boss. But I like the idea that that wasn't a baseball nickname. Like, that was just something he got called around the house to separate the Wanders. It's like, oh, you boss the other ones around. You'll be El Patron. And then the other ones all have little nicknames, too.
El Patron. You be El Patron.
That is one of a kind is Luke Fox. Mm-hmm. And he's on the other side of the break. Let's get his truth serum question and get back into the Leafs. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sports on 590 The Fan.